We can begin with my little review of we talked about sources for spectroscopy for UV visible absorption type measurements, UV visible emission type measurements, even a little bit for IR. And then we went into wavelength selection. I gave you three methods of wavelength selection. Block off the radiation using an optical filter. Disperse and select using a monochromator or modulate the wavelengths using an interferometer. I talked about different kinds of filters. Absorption filters, which could be as something as simple as a colored solution or a piece of colored glass or film. And we had little examples of that. And I talked about the difference between band pass and cutoff or cut-on filters. So this blue one is a cutoff. The red one is a cut-on. Or this would be short pass versus long pass filters. And this would be a band pass in the middle. Although this one in the middle, these are one words. Long pass, short pass, band pass, they're all one word. The band pass filter shown here is kind of an unusual one with a funny profile. But different kinds of filters. The absorption filters have broad wavelength bands that are transmitted, broad peak transmittance, also low peak transmittance. And we measure that. We talked about the effective bandwidth, the nominal wavelength, 500 nanometers, 450 nanometers. We mentioned the width at half height or full width at half height or something like that. And we got into interference filters. And I actually brought an interference filter today. It is a sandwich of two pieces of glass. So when you hold this up, you'll see that there are two pieces of glass. And that's what these are, glass, glass. And then in between the two pieces of glass are three items. Two semi-reflective layers, metallic, and you can see it looks almost like foil, but you can see through it. So it's a sputter deposited or some kind of a coating of metal. And in between is a dielectric, a material that has a certain refractive index to influence the wavelength of light. And we mentioned that light comes in, bounces back and forth, there's interference that occurs, only light that is constructively interfered with is transmitted, okay, out of the filter. All of the rest of the radiation is destructively interfered with and is gone. So, and it matters, you know, the despacing is important. And we talked about the despacing with relation to the wavelength of light. We talked about the wave equation shown here. And despacing, the order of the interference. Okay, so whether it's one wavelength that fits in the despacing or two wavelengths or four wavelengths or whatever it is, it's first order, second order, fourth order light. There's the wavelength and then the refractive index for the dielectric. So if you hold this up and you look through you straight on, you see it's red. Okay, you see red light being transmitted through this interference filter. If you hold it sideways, it kind of gets green. But anyway, so that is a Fabry-Perot type interference filter, and works on a totally different principle than absorption filters. Has different characteristics. I showed you a diagram. There's the despacing shown, and dielectric materials. Let's see. What else did I show you? I showed you this diagram, which has some more terms on it for interference filter, which is really primarily this one. They talk about the center wavelength, peak transmittance, average transmittance, long pass, short pass. They talk about full width at half height, blocking range, different things like that. Good terms for an exam. Okay, so this would be an interference filter that maybe had like a 720 and a 360, right? Because these are M equals 1. I don't know, you have to work out the equation. I'm thinking it's M equals 1, M equals 2. Because 2 times 360 is going to be 720. But figure it out with the equation. So it's first order, second order. You can have multiple orders. You can have many orders in an interference filter. I very briefly went over neutral density filters to describe that it is a type of filter. Since we're talking about filters, I just threw this in. It's a filter that absorbs all wavelengths. So it's not selecting a band for you. It's just reducing the intensity. So if I got too much light and I need to reduce the intensity of that light, I put in a neutral density filter. And I pick the one based on what percentage of light that I want to eliminate. Manufacturers would have you believe that it's a flat profile. And it's not that flat. Okay, it has some character to it. But if you're working in this range, you know, what is it, 400 to 750, well, this particular set of filters from some manufacturer would be appropriate to reduce the intensity, whether you wanted to give you 70% of the light transmitted or 10% of the light transmitted, whatever you want to cut down, you could use a neutral density filter for that. You'll notice, probably, you've all used UV visible absorption instruments at some time or another. Well, when you open up a lot of instruments, when you open up the sample chamber, the sample compartment where you put your cuvettes, where the light comes in, there may be a couple of little clips where you can slide a filter down inside. So you can slide in a neutral density filter if you want to cut the light off. If you have a problem with some instruments, will have second order and first order and second order light passing through the instrument. if I'm only interested in one wavelength and I want to get rid of the second order radiation, then I would select an appropriate filter that transmitted the first order radiation and cut off the second order radiation, or vice versa. So I could use maybe a long pass or a short pass filter or something like that. This is an interference filter that we would pass it around. Okay, that was filters, and we're done with filters. Now we're going to talk about monochromators. So first way was to block or select the wavelength with some kind of a filter. Now we're going to use a monochromator. Monochromator is a little more sophisticated device. As a matter of fact, the monochromator is a lot more sophisticated device than a simple filter, right? Filters are cheap and fairly rugged. You know, we can buy them. We can get our grubby hands all over them. Then we clean them up later. Monochromators have many components and will do a similar job, but they'll usually do a much better job of selecting the wavelength than a filter. So here's my nifty little diagram, and it says here's a simple prism monochromator. I didn't bring in a prism, did I? Nope, I didn't bring a prism in today. But we have a light source. This could be the sun, or it could be a light bulb or whatever. Then we have an entrance slit. A device that will, and all it is an opening, okay, that selects the radiation that we're going to deal with. So this is what's referred to as a slit mask. The instrument may have a big opening, and you slide this down inside, and now you select the slit, and it gives you some numbers on here. What, for the instrument that this is designed for, what band of radiation it might select. Now, entrance slits, it'll make more sense when we talk about exit slits, but the monochromator will have both. So there's an entrance slit, selects the band of radiation. The band of radiation passes, diverging, it's a diverging beam usually, and it hits a lens. What's a lens? We all know what lenses are. Okay, but I brought one in anyway. And this is a convex lens, like the one that's in the, let's see, I could put this in. I can't see much through this. But this is a convex lens, right? It's convex on both sides, and so that would focus the light. Okay, so we have a little lens focusing the light beam, and then if it happens to be in the way this is actually shown, is this is what would be referred to as a collimating lens. A collimating lens makes the light beams go in columns, makes parallel beams. Okay, so it does that to get the light to be displayed across the face of the prism. So here's my prism that's going to do the work. Okay, this is the heart of the system. It's doing all the work. It's going to so the light comes in, goes through an entrance slit, goes through a lens, and is collimated or displayed across the face of the prism. The light goes through the prism. We'll talk about how prisms work. It is dispersed into its component wavelengths. You know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Okay, so it's spread out into its component wavelengths. That light that's spread out may also go through another lens, all right, and then it may go out through an exit slit of the instrument, okay, an exit slit. Or it may, this is the focal plane right here, okay, and it shows here here's the slit mask, okay. So where's that slit mask? All right. So my light beam goes through my prism and lenses and so forth, and it's spread out. And I got red on one end, and red, orange, yellow, blue, indigo, violet. Okay. So I've got purple or violet or ultraviolet on the other end. So I've got the spectrum of light displayed in space. Okay. I decide I want green light. Last time I was talking about green light. So what do? I locate that spectrum with respect to this slit. So you can say, well, I put the slit in a certain place, or I move the spectrum, I move my prism. But whatever it is, I want the green light to go through the opening. Okay? I want the green light to go through the opening, and so that's how I select the green radiation. I select, 400 and whatever green is. The exit slit is at the focal plane. Now, what do I see at the focal plane? Okay, what do I see? You see this little sun over here? It's a circle, and it's got these little spikies coming out of it. Okay, I know I'm not much of an artist. Okay. On the red end of the spectrum, I see, let's say it is the sun, okay, just for yucks, okay, humor me, okay. So I'm a 17th century spectroscopist, and I'm doing, and my light source is the sun. So I go through a prism, I have the light dispersed into its component colors, it's white light coming out of the sun, and on the focal plane, what do I see? Well, on the red end, I see a red sun. And if my slit mask is at the red end of the spectrum, has isolated the red radiation, I see the sun. I see the entire sun, the whole big ball with all the rays coming out of it. Okay? That's what that's supposed to look like. And it's red. Okay? It's red because all the information is there, but it's in red, it's in the red wavelengths. Okay? And that's what I'm looking at. If I move my exit slit, okay, my little exit slit over to the green part of the spectrum. How do I do that? Come on. My computer is giving me trouble. So I move it over to the green part of the spectrum. This is a long way to go to make a point. What do I see? I see the sun, the same sun, but it's green. Then I move to the, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Whatever part of the spectrum I look, I get all that information of the image, but I see it in the color that I've selected where I'm observing at the focal plane. I'm looking through my little slit mask, okay? And if I put it in one location, or I could rotate the prism, okay, or move the focal lens there and focus that image wherever I want. Usually the slit is fixed, okay, and we rotate the prism or whatever. Okay, So there's how a monochromator works. What's the monochromator? Monochromators are green. No, they're not. The monochromators are a box. Okay, it's just I told you, it's a big empty box. It's not really empty. It'll have an entrance slit on one end, usually on the end. It doesn't have to be on the end. It could be in different locations. And on one end, typically there's an entrance slit, then inside, lens, prism, whatever. And then on the other end, or somewhere else on the box, on the mostly empty box, is an exit slit. My source is not part of the monochromator. My source, we already talked about sources. My detector, we're going to talk about them later. Next class. All right, and that's not part of the monochromator. The box that has an entrance and exit slit is my monochromator. It includes prisms, lenses, mirrors, gratings. We'll talk about gratings. Devices like that for focusing and dispersing the light, but selecting the radiation that we want to do our spectroscopy. Okay, so here's some information. Entrance slit selects the light. The prism disperses it. Then we get the light at the focal plane. We have an exit slit. Blah, blah, blah. We could have a prism or a diffraction grating. We use lenses or mirrors. We could, what we're going to find out later is, rather than use a slit like this and a detector to detect one wavelength of light, you know, like the red light or the green light or the blue or whatever, we could use an imaging detector. Okay, we could put, in a simplest case, in the old days they had imaging detectors. They used a photographic plate. They used a piece of photographic film and they put it at the focal plane and they got the complete spectrum across that piece of film. We have an instrument downstairs that actually has a photographic attachment. You use Polaroid film. You bought the Polaroid film. You put it into this, what was called a camera back. It was like, and the film was like this big. And you put that into the instrument and in the dark, so it's not exposed, right? And then you do your experiment, your spectroscopic experiment. You shine the light through the monochromator, and it's dispersed. And on the face of that film, you got the spectrum of light. Okay, maybe red, orange, yellow, blue, green, indigo, violet, spread across the film. So that would be an imaging detector. And what would I see? I would see a red sun, you know, an orange sun, a yellow sun, and now they'd be a sort of a continuum of suns, okay, because I have the continuous spectrum. And they would go from being the red sun, the red source, the red image of the source. If it was a light bulb, okay, if we cross this out and I drew a light bulb, okay, something like that. That's my light bulb. That's a light bulb. You didn't know that was a light bulb? That's a light bulb. You'd see the image of the light bulb in all the different colors spread across the focal plane. So we could use an image detector. We'll talk about those later on. Or we could use a single wavelength detector like a photomultiplier tube, a photodiode or something like that. All right, moving right along. In order to make these things that we're talking about, we need to discuss optical materials. We need things that are optically transparent, right? This will work. Okay, this is optically transparent, right? Light passes through there. However, this blocks off radiation, right? So we need materials that are optically transparent. What are we going to use? Well, in the visible region, we're going to use glass. We can use glass down to about 350 nanometers. It is it absorbs in the infrared region, but who cares? We can't see there anyway. And it goes from the higher, longer wavelengths, infrared region, down to the visible, but maybe 350 or 300, depending upon the particular type of glass that it is. In the UV region, we use quartz. So we can go beyond or lower than 350 nanometers if we use quartz. In the IR region, we have to use salts like KBR, sodium chloride, whatever. So the actual lenses in an infrared spectrometer, a conventional infrared, but not an FTIR type instrument, because FTIR instruments often don't have lenses. But in an infrared instrument that has lenses, the lenses are actually made of sodium chloride. Please don't rinse them under the sink, okay? But the lenses, the cell holders, all the optical materials have to be made of something that's IR transparent. That would be a salt, sodium chloride, potassium bromide, whatever. Okay, we can also use plastic in the visible region. I brought in a plastic cuvette the other day. Now, plastic's not very rugged, right? You clean it up with a Kim wipe, and you're bound to scratch it. Glass, pretty solid. You can clean it, all right? So we have all these different optical materials. If I'm going to make a cell holder to hold my sample, got to have the right optical materials. If I'm going to make lenses to focus the light, it's got to be the right optical material for the wavelengths of light that I'm concerned with. Okay? Salts are sensitive to moisture, and the heavier the atoms of the salt. Okay, so that's all pretty basic stuff. All right, let's digress for a moment and talk about some optical parameters that we need to understand in order to describe monochromators and the function of a monochromator. The first one on this slide is resolution. Okay, resolution is the ability to distinguish as separate the wavelengths or frequencies of light that are close to each other. Okay, and so it is pretty simple. R is resolution. Okay, R is resolution, and it's described here either in terms of frequency or wavelength. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm taking, and I like wavelength. People who do work in the visible and UV region often use nanometers, and they use wavelength. If you are doing NMR spectroscopy, you use frequency. But we can interconvert frequency to wavelength, so you could use wavelength for NMR. We would be talking about meters if we were doing NMR in wavelength, because it's radio waves, and radio waves have wavelengths on the order of meters. If you're doing infrared spectroscopy, people talk about wave numbers rather than wavelength. Okay, or frequency. It's just what's convenient for that type of spectroscopy. So I'm going to talk nanometers. So typically, resolution in nanometers is going to be the wavelength that I'm interested in divided by the range of wavelengths or the band of radiation, the band pass that's going through my monochromator. If I have a big band pass, I got bad resolution. Okay, because delta lambda, this is delta lambda, right? Delta lambda appears in the denominator. The larger the number is in the denominator, the smaller the R is going to be. So if I have a big band pass, I got lousy resolution. If I'm able to distinguish individual wavelengths better, I'm able to narrow that band pass. And my band pass, remember I gave you the example before the other day of 300 nanometers, and I had 301 and 299. Okay, 2 nanometer band pass. That's a good band pass. Okay, it can give you smaller. Okay, I have an instrument downstairs that has a big monochromator on it that has sub-angstrom resolution. Angstroms are one-tenth the size of a nanometer. So 0.1 nanometers is one angstrom. I'm talking about hundredths of angstroms, okay, or thousandths of nanometers resolution. Okay, that's very high resolution. Your typical UV visible instrument might have a few nanometers as the resolution. 2, 3, 5, 10. Not so good, 10 nanometers. But think about the filters that we talked about, okay, the filters. The filter, okay? The filter has a broader band pass, 50 nanometers, right? So it's poor resolution, whereas monochromators can give you better. So we could talk about resolution in terms of wavelength. We could talk about it in frequency. Notice there is not an equal sign here. Resolution and frequency and resolution and wavelength are not the same because they're different units, right? We interconverted before at the beginning of this section of the molecular spectroscopy. We gave you the equation to interconvert frequency, the relationship between frequency and wavelength related to the speed of light, refractive index. Okay, so these are resolution is a dimensionless term. It can be expressed in frequency, it can be expressed in wavelength, it can be expressed in other terms also. All right, then we have the idea of dispersion. That's just the spread of wavelengths in space. So if you're with me on the concept of my prism, just spreading the wavelengths in space, right? Giving me different colors of the light, of the white light into it, into the components of colors of the spectrum, then we have this concept of dispersion. Now, in the case of dispersion, when you stop and think about it, you realize that I can have angular dispersion. What's angular dispersion? Well, I got a prism, okay, and the light comes in, okay, hits my prism, and is spread over some angle. And maybe we have red up here. I'll go through this again. Red up here, okay, and other colors, right? Red, orange, yellow, blue, or excuse me, green, blue. Anyway, I got the spectrum, okay? It's spread over some angle, okay? So if there's an angle over which the light is spread, we can talk about angular dispersion, okay? Angular dispersion. If I'm close to the prism or I'm far away from the prism, the angle is the same, right? Just, you know how angles work? They work. Okay, so angular dispersion says there's a d theta that over which the wave band is spread. So it's the angle. Okay, so if we talk about the change in the angle versus the or the spread of the angle versus the spread of the wavelengths, it's d theta d lambda. And angles can be in radians, you know, 2 pi radians in a circle, and wavelength is in nanometers, so it's radians per nanometer. So that's angular dispersion, all right? If that angular dispersion then focuses its light on a focal plane, like in my diagram a minute ago, and the focal plane, things are in focus at some... My eyesight's getting bad. I'm getting old, okay? I had a birthday the other day. So I'm getting old, right? So what happens when your eyes get old? They lose their ability to change shape and focus, right? So what happens is, now when I'm reading things, I have to hold them over here, right? Because my eyes won't, when I look at something quite like this, it's blurry, okay? So I have to hold it further away. My eye is not able to focus on things up close. So I'm getting farsighted. That's a natural thing that occurs with aging, right? So, the focal plane for me is now out here. It used to be I could adjust my eye, would change its shape, okay? The muscles in my eye would change the shape of the eyeball and change the lens, and so therefore I would be able to focus it close up or far away. But now my focal plane is out here, okay? So the light comes through my monochromator and it's dispersed by my prism. The light is spread out. And it focuses the image of that sun, the picture of the sun that's in red and orange and yellow and all the different colors, is only in focus at a certain location. That's the focal plane. At that focal plane, okay, the spread of wavelengths, which are some angle, and the angle doesn't matter where you are. If you're at the focal, it doesn't matter. It's the same angle wherever you are, okay, because the light is dispersed in some fixed angular pattern. But at the focal plane, on the focal plane, we could measure the linear dispersion, the distance between the red light and the orange light, and the distance between the orange and the yellow. Now, we'd have to specify a wavelength. We'd have to say 600 nanometers in the red, okay, compared to 500 nanometers in the orange, okay, something like that. We'd have to specify the wavelength, but there's a spread on the focal plane that is in terms of distance. So that gives us linear dispersion. So now it's a dx distance, okay, or a change in x for the spread of wavelengths, over which the wave band, d lambda, is spread at the focal plane. It has to be at the focal plane. Everywhere else it's just blurry. All right. So it's dx d lambda, or it's in millimeters per nanometer. Millimeters would be the distance. Nanometers, which is also a length measurement, happens to be what we're using for the units of our wavelengths of light. Now, so now we've got angular dispersion and linear dispersion. The angular dispersion doesn't matter what the focal length is or the focal plane, where the focal plane is, what that distance is. It's still the same everywhere. Linear dispersion, it matters that you're at the focal plane. So you have to specify. Now, if you really want to sound like you know what you're doing, okay, you really want to sound like you're an expert in the field, okay, you just talk about linear reciprocal dispersion. Now, what's linear reciprocal dispersion? It's just the upside down version of linear dispersion. Okay, it's just the reciprocal. We just take the millimeters per nanometer and we make them nanometers per millimeter. Why do monochromator manufacturers use linear reciprocal dispersion? Probably to confuse you, I think. That's my only thought. Okay, we could take the reciprocal of everything, right? How tall are you? Do you want that in distance? Do you want that in the reciprocal length? Anyway, okay, so there's three terms: angular dispersion, linear dispersion, linear reciprocal dispersion. Okay, next term. Related terms, not that related, but related, is the spectral slit width, bandpass, or bandwidth. All right, so we've already talked about these, but there are three terms. They all mean the same thing, pretty much. If I'm talking about spectral slit width, I'm talking about the range of wavelengths in the spectrum that are passing through the exit slit of the monochromator, and therefore tells me something about the resolution of my instrument. Here's a funny thing. This little slit mask says 10 nanometers over here. It says 20 nanometers over here. How wide do you think that opening is? How big is it in nanometers?
Many.
Many. How many?
Like
many. Well, it's probably in nanometers. It might be thousands. Okay. So wait a second. This says it's 10 nanometers. It's a 10 nanometer slit mask or a 20 nanometer slit mask, but the opening, the slit, is like it's like a couple of millimeters wide. Okay. So how's that work? Well, the way it works is because when I locate this slit at the focal plane where the light is dispersed, the section, the slice of the spectrum that it selects is either 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers. Well, which is it, 10 or 20? Well, it depends on the dispersion device. This is used for two different dispersion devices, and I'll explain that later on. But so this... maybe it's 2 millimeter wide, okay, slit mask selects either 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers depending on the resolution of the device, the dispersion ability of the device, okay? So I locate this large opening at the focal plane and it selects for me a spectral band pass of 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers. That's what this is talking about. See how it says spectral slit width? See, I could say to you, oh, there's a slit width. What's the slit width? Well, the slit width, you could say, is 2 millimeters. But that doesn't have anything to do with spectroscopy, right? So a slit width, a slit mask of 2 millimeters wide is going to translate to a spectral slit width of 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers in the particular instrument that is used in. All right. So usually when we're talking about bandwidth or bandpass, we know that it's the band of radiation. Okay, it's the band of radiation that we're discussing. All right, the band of radiation says half maximum intensity. Oh, I don't have the diagram. Later I'll show you the diagram. I'll talk again about slits, but you end up with a distribution that's triangular, almost like a peak, and it's at the half of the height that you measure that bandpass. Just like it was for filters that we talked about. Okay, lenses. I already passed around the lens. This is the lens equation for a thin lens. Okay, if you have thick glasses, all right, and you're blind, the lens equation gets more complicated. But this is a simple lens equation. F is the focal length. Okay, so. And I have a diagram down here at the bottom, right? So focal length, right? So from the lens, I drew this myself, to the focal point. All right, we talk about focal point or focal length. Focal point is the location. Focal length is the distance between a lens and a focal point. So 1 over F is equal to, now, there's two refractive indices, N and N prime. What are they? Well, there's the material that the lens is in, that the lens is made of, glass, quartz, plastic, whatever, sodium chloride, whatever you might be using for your lens. And then the adjacent material. Well, that's air, right? Unless you're doing underwater spectroscopy. Okay, so it could be something else, could be something other than air. 99% of the time it's air, but if you're on Mars, okay, there's not much air up there, right? So it could be a vacuum, it could be something else, all right? But we do have to know the refractive index of the lens and the adjacent material, and then we need to know the radius of curvature. Why are there two radius of curvatures? Well, this lens, I only brought in one lens. This lens looks like it's like the lens that I drew, okay? It looks like that lens. It has a similar or same radius of curvature on either side. Don't look too close. I drew that, okay? So it looks the same, the radius of curvature. R1 and R2 would be the same for this kind of lens. However, if you took your glasses off, you'll notice that your glasses don't have the same radius of curvature on the front and the back surface. As a matter of fact, they're not even convex. They'll probably have one convex side and one concave side, right? Or if you're a spectroscopist, you probably wear glasses that look like this, and you see things in different colors. Okay, but whatever the lens is, okay, the lens has a radius of curvature on each side. The lens could look like this. 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 No, it can't look like that. All right, so you have a different radius of curvature in each side of the lens. Oops! So that's all part of the lens equation. Okay, so you put that all together, all right, and that tells us something about the focal length versus where the image is. So here's my image, all right? And the image is upside down. Why is that? Because when you go through the a convex lens like this, okay, the image is inverted. If you put two lenses together, you get the back right side up. So if I look through this lens, if I find the focal point, oh, you can see it. You probably didn't do. I didn't tell you to do this experiment. If you hold the lens like this, I see the entire classroom upside down in this lens. Okay, the entire classroom is upside down because it inverts the image. All right, so it inverts. You can go around, take it again, and look. Do the shouldn't probably throw it across the desk like I did, but anyway. So the image, the light reflecting off of the image. Okay, so light from the overhead lights reflects off the image, goes through the focal plane, through the lens, and then is observed at some location. So I did it backwards. I described it backwards. It's the object, okay? So the light's reflecting off the object. It goes through the lens, through the focal plane, and I see the image upside down. Okay? I see the light formed from the focus of the lens in an inverted form, upside down, as the image that actually hits me in the brain, okay? It's transferred on my retina.
If the bifocal plane, I mean the lens, is equal, so this equation you need to zero. You know,
what if?
Would be
if what and what?
If R1 and R2 are equal, so we subtract from each other.
That's a good point. Let me think about that for a minute. Lens equation for a thin lens. Thin lens. Radius of curvature. 1 over... Yeah, so what does that mean? If it's 0, what does that mean to us? I'll have to think about that a little bit. 1 over... Yeah, it's infinity. What's infinity minus infinity? Yeah, I'll have to think about that. It could be an infinitely, it could give you an infinitely large focal focal length. But let me think about that and get back to you on the significance of that. All right, the significance of that particular situation. But the idea that we want to get across here is how lenses work. Lenses do work, right? Lenses work. We see an image; it will focus the image in a particular location at a particular focal point, and we'll be able to see that image. In a single lens like this one, convex lens, it's an inverted image. Even on many spectrometers, the image is inverted, but nobody cares. We don't care that the image is inverted as long as we get the spectral information that we're interested in. So, in practice, we might use something like this to set up the location of our image in our lenses. Depending on the lenses that we happen to have, we may know the focal length. Okay, I have a box here. It's actually a mirror inside here, but it has a 15 centimeter focal length. It's a 50 millimeter diameter. In this case, it's a mirror, and it has a 15 centimeter focal length. All right, so. We can use these in our optical devices. We can use them in our monochromator. Okay. Focal length, we mentioned already, is important for lenses, but it's also important for the monochromator. Now, I'm giving you real simple cases. If you've ever, when I was a graduate student, I got interested in photography. Okay, and so I bought a 35 millimeter camera, which has a lens on it. But the lens on a 35 millimeter camera is not a single piece of glass like that. It's a multiple pieces of glass put together to make a lens that you can focus on objects near and far, a zoom lens maybe or whatever. When we put several lenses together, the system will, the combination of the two lenses will also have a focal length. When I put lenses together in a monochromator, the monochromator begins. Also has a focal length that becomes an intrinsic characteristic of that combination of lenses. All right. So, in a system where I put them all together, we'll have a focal length. We may take two lenses. Let's take the simple case. This example I showed you at the beginning of class was a two lens system. A lens to focus the light coming in, a lens to focus the light after it had been dispersed by the prism. The combination of those two lenses will give us a focal length. There's equations that we could talk about that will allow us to take different lenses of different focal lengths, of different radius of curvatures, of different refractive indices, and put them together to give me the focal length of the system that I have when I put the two together. Focal length, okay, in a monochromator is important. It shows here a focal point, okay. The focal length, which we saw a minute ago, okay, would be this. In a collimating lens, if that lens right there can be made to be a collimating lens, if I were to put my light source at the focal point, okay, and shine the light through the lens, I would get, coming out of the lens, parallel beams, as shown here, or collimated beams, beams that are in parallel in space. That is important if I want to focus the light onto a device like the prism that we talked about. Okay, focal length, it says here, then there's F number. Okay, the 35 millimeter camera that I bought, which I still have, when I was a graduate student, okay, that it had two lenses. Okay, it had a small lens that was sort of a wide-angle type lens. It wasn't a real wide-angle, but it was a wide-angle. So if I want to get scenery, if I want to take a picture of a building, okay, I have a lens that had a fairly wide angle, and it was very small lens. It had probably two pieces of glass in it, two lenses that could be adjusted in order to give that wide-angle picture. Then I had a big lens that had that was a zoom telephoto and had multiple pieces of glasses, and you could zoom in and out, and you could focus right in on something. And if it was a macro zoom, so you could focus in on, you know, the little bee that's landed on the flower. Oh, such beautiful photography. Okay, or we could zoom in on somebody that's, you know, 1,000 yards away. We could zoom in on them. Okay, so the F number of those two lenses is different. Why? Well, think about it. If I have two lenses, okay, F number is a, I got to say this first. F number is a measure of the light gathering power, the ability of that lens to gather light. Well, this lens, operating by itself, light can come from anywhere, from a big wide angle, okay, and can go through this lens and pass through to the other side. I start to put lenses together. What happens? Okay. Well, first of all, I can't gather light from all over the place. It's got to be a beam that's going to pass through the lenses. Secondly, the lenses are made of material. What happens every time light passes from one substance to another, because of the refractive index, we get light reflected off. Okay, so some of that 4% reflection occurs. So all of a sudden, as I start putting lenses together, the F number of the lens, of the series of lenses, becomes such that I don't have as much light gathering power. Now I'm careful, because F number is one of those upside down parameters. It's focal length divided by lens clear aperture. What's lens clear aperture? It's not here. Okay. It is, if I put that lens, what do I do with it? If I put it into a holder, okay, something to hold it, right? I can't use the edge of the lens, right? Because okay? So I can only use, I can't, if this has a diameter of 2.5 centimeters, I don't know what it is, okay? But if it has a diameter of 2.5 centimeters, I may only be able to use 2 centimeters. So the lens clear aperture may only be 2 centimeters for this particular lens, right? I can't use the entire opening. I can't use the entire aperture. Aperture is an opening. So how much of it is clear to have light pass through? Only a portion of it. So the focal length of the lens divided by the lens clear aperture defines for me the light gathering power of that lens, or of a series of lenses. Realizing, of course, that if I have two lenses, one lens can gather light from a big radius. Okay, two lenses together, the radius over which the light gathering power of that series of lenses can now operate is smaller, because the light from the one lens has to pass through the other lens, and so we have a lower lens clear aperture. So F number is a measure of light gathering power. Larger F number means less light. So my on my 35 millimeter camera, my small lens, that was the wide angle lens, okay, had a low F number, okay, which meant it could get lots of light. But my big lens had a higher F number lens, but it couldn't gather as much light, because it had to go through all those different pieces of glass that were inside of that zoom telephoto lens, which is about this long. Okay, it wasn't very expensive. It was this long. You've seen the people on who take pictures of the sporting events and so on. They got these lenses. They're this big around, and they're on their camera. The camera is only this big. The lens is like this big. Okay. Anyway, the light gathering power. Okay, that I said F number is a measure of light gathering power. That comes about through this relationship. So you might call it P for power, is proportional to 1 over the F number squared. F number is just F with a line, right? It's just a funny symbol. So F with a line squared. Okay, so it's the reciprocal of the F number, but it's the squared relationship. All right? So you have to remember that. Okay, remember that. That'll be on the test. All right? Now, lenses are one way to focus light and to get light onto a system, but also we can use mirrors. I brought in a mirror. This one is the one, I brought in two, but actually we'll just hand this one around, because this is the one that we that we always use, and we put our grubby hands all over it. Remember I told you about the mirror that you looked at this morning? You looked in the mirror, right? Combed your hair. Oh, hi. It's me. That has a rear silvered surface. So it's a piece of glass, you know, maybe it's only this thick. And on the back of it, it has a silvered surface. So you're looking through the glass, and then the light is reflecting off of the mirrored surface and back through the glass. Well, we don't do that in spectroscopy because that glass has a refractive index and causes us problems. So we take a piece of glass, in this case it's a quite thick piece of glass, and we put the silvered surface on the front of it. And you never touch the silvered surface on the front of the mirror, okay? Because it messes it up. And as you look at this mirror, you'll say, that's messed up. But if you look carefully, you can see yourself. Oh, man, am I handsome. And so this came right out of a spectrophotometer, right? This was bolted down on the optical bench of a spectrophotometer, and it has adjustments here. You can turn these screws to adjust a mirror just right, and you can actually clean these up. Hopefully you notice there's pits, and the edge is a little bit worn, and about this length, you can see yourself. All right, okay. So that is a mirror used in a spectrophotometer. Now, that is a concave mirror. Okay, you can tell it's not perfectly flat. You have to hold it at a certain distance in order to get the image clear. Why? Because there's a focal length, right? There's a focal length for that mirror, just like there were for lenses. Straight piece of glass that we have in our windows, this is no focal length, right? The radius of curvature is infinity, I think. It has to do with infinity, okay? But because it's flat, and so it would be an infinitely large circle, okay? That's how we measure the radius of curvature, right? The lens has a curvature. We draw a circle, okay? We measure the radius of that circle. That's the radius of curvature of the lens or the mirror, right? So the lenses and mirrors can be used for focusing light and gathering light. Okay, so mirrors in very high-quality instruments. Why high quality? Because lenses cause us problems with light absorption, light reflection, scattering, things like that. But if I use front surface mirrors, I don't have problems like that. Okay, I didn't mention chromatic aberrations. It's not on my slide for some reason. Okay. Lenses have chromatic aberrations. What's a chromatic aberration? That's a fancy word for color. Chromatic is color. Aberration is something, an anomaly, a problem. Okay? Lenses have color problems. Okay? They don't focus all the colors the same. Really? The entire spectrum of light passing through the lens, all the red light is not actually focused the same as the blue light. Right. They have actually different focal. Remember the lens equation? It had refractive index in it, right? Refractive index actually varies with wavelength. So if I'm dealing with different wavelengths of light, then the red light is going to be focused differently than the blue light. So that causes a chromatic aberration. A chromatic aberration would say that my focal point for the red is different than the focal point for the blue. Now, in most cases, in cases of like eyeglasses and things like that, it's not really a problem. Okay, we don't at the resolution that our eye is able to handle, it doesn't make any difference. The difference in the focal length is so small, we see the red image and the blue image at the same location. That's not a big deal. But in a monochromator, where we are amplifying or magnifying these effects, we can have a problem with a chromatic aberration. So I use a mirror to deal with that. Okay. Now this says a spherical mirror, one that is perfectly spherical, can have chromatic aberrations, and that tells you that the chromatic aberration doesn't define it here. Okay. This says avoids chromatic aberration. So all we've got is our object, like we had before. Light reflects off the object, goes to the mirror, goes through the focal plane, and forms an image. All right. If you look through the mirror, you could see an image. Okay, you could see an image. It's a slightly different relationship than we had with the lens. Okay, I think it was a minus, or it was, it would be object minus image, so it would be this subtracted from that. Anyway, if you don't have, so lenses have chromatic aberrations. Mirrors can fix the chromatic aberration, but then it says here a spherical mirror will have a spherical aberration. Okay, and the spherical aberration, do I define it somewhere? I got it, here it is. Spherical aberration, if I have light beams coming in, those that are off axis, where's the axis? The axis is in the middle. So light beams that are off axis will have a slightly different focal point than those light beams that are near the axis. Okay, so that's a problem. I can fix the spherical aberration problem. So I got a spherical mirror, a mirror that defines a sphere. All right? I can fix it in three ways, and they're listed here on the bottom of the slide, to fix the spherical aberration. The fact that the focal length for light beams at the outer part of the sphere is not the same as the focal length for the items at the inner part of the sphere. Okay, so how do I fix it? Well, I could only use the center of the lens and waste all this extra space out here. So I take a big mirror like this, and I might only use the middle to prevent the spherical aberration problem. That's a wasteful way of doing it, but you could do it that way. Secondly, I could use a parabolic mirror. Okay, instead of defining the concave, the radius of curvature by a sphere, I make it a parabola. What's a parabola? It's a geometric figure that's not a sphere. Okay, so I just change the shape of the curvature so that it's not defining a circle, but it's defining some other object. All right, and then I make that such that it prevents the spherical aberrations. The problem is that that's very difficult to do, very expensive. So a parabolic mirror, you know, like the one used in the Hubble telescope, okay, a parabolic mirror might cost you, might set you back a few mil. Okay, so not for a spectrophotometer, but a parabolic mirror is an expensive device. Or I can use a Schmidt corrector. What's a Schmidt corrector? A Schmidt corrector is nothing more than a lens. Right, it's a lens that has a zero radius of, or an infinite radius of curvature on one side and another radius of curvature on the other side. And what does it do? It takes the light beams and it spreads them a little bit so that when they display on a spherical mirror, they have the right focal plane, focal point. Okay, so this is all just stuff that you, if you were building a spectrophotometer and you needed to build a monochromator to select the wavelengths, you would have to consider all of these things. Oh, I'll just get a lens and I'll do this. Well, lenses have problems. Lenses absorb light. Lenses reflect light. Lenses have chromatic aberrations. Oh, okay, I won't use a lens. I'll use a mirror. Okay, what kind of mirror? Oh, I'll just use a spherical mirror. Oh, no, spherical mirror has problems. It has spherical aberrations. And mirrors aren't as rugged. Right, the lens, I can polish it up, clean it, you know. Okay, the mirror, I can't do that to. I got to be a little bit more careful. It's more expensive, so I've got to take all of these things into consideration as I build my spectrophotometer. Astigmatism. Okay, this is people who have bad eyesight. Maybe if you're not nearsighted or farsighted, you probably have an astigmatism. Objects, an object off axis, the horizontal and vertical focuses are different. Okay, so the focus in this direction versus the focus in this direction are at different places. That's an astigmatism. The focal points are not in the same place. All right. This is a problem if you have a poor quality lens or a poor quality mirror. You can have an astigmatism. You get two images and they're displaced from each other. Numerical aperture, like lens clear aperture. Okay, I talked a minute ago about the idea of lens clear aperture, the portion of the lens that will accept light. Numerical aperture is the same thing. It's an angle over which the monochromator, which is a system of lenses or mirrors or whatever you made them out of, that entrance slit will accept radiation. Obviously, if I have a little bitty monochromator with just maybe two lenses in it, right? Okay? Well, the light coming in here can pass through, and it can still get through the device. Okay? If I have a really big monochromator, okay, and my lenses are over here, well, this light coming through here is going to miss that lens. So it cuts down my numerical aperture. I can't accept light over a wide range. My numerical aperture gets reduced, and I can only accept light over a narrow range of angles, okay, for light to come into that device. All right, I mentioned before slits, entrance and exit slits. Okay, downstairs in my lab, I have a fluorescence instrument. It has little monochromators on it, itsy bitsy monochromators. You go into the next room, and I have a plasma emission spectrometer that has big monochromator. Okay, open up inside; they're both empty. Okay, but they both have mirrors. Okay, at the wall. As a matter of fact, the little box has two mirrors, and the whole big box is empty. Right, but they each have an entrance slit and an exit slit. An entrance slit to let light in after it's been dispersed, an exit slit to let the light out. So we have slits. The slits are designed specifically so that they let out the right amount of light, the amount of light that you need for your experiment. If I close the slit way down to get better resolution, right? Because remember, I got a range of wavelengths being dispersed by my dispersion device, my prism or whatever. So I got to band the radiation at the focal plane. I want 1 nanometer resolution. Okay, I close my slit down to a point where I get just a one nanometer band of radiation coming out of the monochromator. When I close that slit down, I also lose power. The light that's coming through, I've cut off the light. I've closed the slit down so I don't get as much light coming through. So my light throughput is less when I'm under conditions where I get high resolution. Oh, okay, forget it then. I'll open up the slits and make them wide because I want a lot of light to get through. My light throughput goes up, my resolution goes down because as I open up the slit, I don't get one nanometer band of radiation. I get a 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 nanometer band of radiation. So my throughput went up, my amount of light power goes up, but my resolution goes down. This is a problem in spectroscopy. There's a trade-off. Okay? There's a trade-off between throughput and resolution. I can't have good both. I can't have high light throughput and high resolution. It doesn't work that way. Because in order to get high resolution, I have to cut down the amount of light that passes through, select from the band the light that I want. So, decreasing the slit width, you gain resolution, you lose energy throughput. Open the slits wider, increase the signal or throughput, but lose resolution. Energy throughput must be sufficient for the detector to measure. Okay, so what's the bottom line is, if I want to do an experiment in spectroscopy, I've got to be able to detect the light. You got to be able to see the light. You know, do you see the light? Yeah. In order to see the light, my detector's got to be able to respond, so there has to be sufficient light for the detector to give us a signal. So, energy throughput must be sufficient for the detector to measure a signal with adequate precision. If I can just barely measure the light and I'm getting a noisy signal, I'm not going to have good precision. It's going to be plus or minus, 10%, plus or minus 50%, okay? Lousy. So I've got to have enough energy throughput. Now the other practical consideration. So practical consideration number one, I've got to have enough light to give me a signal. Practical consideration number two, the image of the entrance slit. What's the image of the entrance slit? The image is whatever the source looks like, right? So I told you, if it's the sun, I see a picture of the sun. If it's a light bulb, a tungsten filament light bulb, I see a picture of that light bulb passing through my monochromator. That image that I've selected, I might not see the whole light bulb or the whole sun. I might have cut the slit down so I only see a portion of it. that image, whatever it is, if it fills the exit slit, the image created by the entrance slit, if it fills the entire exit slit, then I have matched my entrance and exit slits appropriately to give me the best efficiency. Efficiency, spectral efficiency. The balance between light throughput and resolution. It might be on the next slide. It's not, though. I'll talk to you about it later. Okay, so in practice, the image engine fills the exit slit. Otherwise, the larger slit establishes or limits the resolution. So the larger slit, if I have one of the slits, entrance or exit, is big, that's going to give me poor resolution, and it's going to affect my whole system. So the larger slit always limits your resolution, but also the smaller slit always limits or establishes your throughput. So you have to match the two of them if you want the system to work efficiently. Okay, optical efficiency is something we'll talk about in a few minutes. Okay, there's a theoretical minimum. If I make the slit really too small, I start to get diffraction. Okay, the spreading of a band of radiation. Okay, so we don't want that. Here's what I started to tell you about a few minutes ago, how the light passing through the slit has a triangular distribution of power. So this is relative power on this scale, and here's my wavelength along the x-axis. So I've selected, I've got my monochromator, I've got an entrance slit, I've got a light source coming through, I've got some lenses or mirrors or whatever, a prism, it displays the spectrum of light, and out the exit slit comes a band of radiation, and I decide I want green radiation, so I get a green, I select that portion of the spectrum, and out comes green light. The green light that comes out has its maximum power right in the center, usually. Okay? In the center of the band, I get the maximum power. I set the monochromator, let's say, to 450 nanometers. Okay, let's say I dialed in 450 nanometers. So out of the monochromator comes the 450 nanometer band. That is lambda zero. That's ground zero. That's what I selected, 450 nanometers. I told you, though, that there's going to be 451 and 449. But there also might be 452, 453, 454, 455. There might also be 449, 448, 447, 446, 445. Okay? Depends on my band pass, right? As it turns out, my band pass is defined at the half the maximum power, just like it was defined for the optical filters that we talked about. Full width at half maximum. So we had a spectral distribution for the filter. We took the maximum power, we divided it in two, we took the width of the band, and that defined my band pass. The same is true here. Okay? The same is true here. We're going to take the maximum power at the central wavelength that we've dialed in, and we're going to take the width of that band at half the maximum power. So, what's the width of that band right there? How many nanometers? How many? No. It's on the bottom. It's plus, minus 10, 20. 10, 20. Okay, so this band is a 20 nanometer band. Right? It's 10 on this side, 10 on that side, gives me 20 nanometers. But actually, the light coming out covers a 40 nanometer band, but the intensity is really low. Because, right? Because the power over here is almost zero. It is zero at minus 20 and at 20. But we decided that we're going to take it at half the maximum power. So at half power, we got a 20 nanometer band pass, or 20 nanometer bandwidth, 20 nanometer band pass, 20 nanometer spectral slit width, whatever you want to call it. All right? So it's the range of wavelengths passing. Here's my optical efficiency, okay, that I was looking for a minute ago. All right? The optical efficiency is defined as throughput times resolution. See, I said there's a trade-off, throughput and resolution, but we multiply the two of them together, and it gives us overall optical efficiency. If I match my slits, okay, the power coming through each of the slits, and the resolution, and the band of radiation that comes in the entrance slit exactly fills the exit slit, then I have the optimum optical efficiency that I can get from that system. Now, the overall optical efficiency is defined not only by the throughput and not only by the band, the matching of the slits, but also by the overall throughput of light, the amount of power that comes through. The light may get cut off, right? Some of the light gets cut off. And the resolution, how well I can disperse and select, right? If I have zero resolution, what happens? The light beam that comes in comes out, right? There's no resolution. Nothing is split into its component parts. Okay. When it comes to optical efficiency, a prism-based monochromator has the lowest optical efficiency of all the systems that we'll talk about. But it's easy to understand, so that's what I've been talking about. A grating monochromator, a monochromator, exact same device, but I took the prism out, I ripped the prism out, I wrenched it out, I took a screwdriver and I pried it out, and I replaced it with a grating. What's a grating? I'll give you one to play with. Okay, it's another device for dispersing radiation, and it's about the same size as a prism. It can be. So we can take a monochromator that has lenses or mirrors or whatever, entrance slit, exit slits, big empty box, and I can either use a prism or I can use a grating. Okay, a grating monochromator has better optical efficiency than a prism monochromator. Okay, so a grating monochromator is better than a prism monochromator. Then there's this device known as an interferometer. An interferometer has very, very, very large throughput. It doesn't even have entrance or exit slits. Okay, they're not even part of the system. And so, because I don't have entrance and exit slits, I'm not cutting down the light. I'm passing the entire band of radiation through the system, and I'm modulating it. Okay, we'll talk about how that works later. And I get all the light out, so I have much greater throughput, so I have much greater optical efficiency. Okay, I still have an ability. There's still some limits in my ability to resolve wavelengths in an interferometer. Okay, it's still my ability to distinguish as different two nearly identical wavelengths of light. So I'm still going to have a resolution issue with interferometers, so they don't, even though I'm using a large band of radiation, I get much greater throughput, but I still have resolution issues. Okay. So this is all about optical efficiency. All right, let's talk about those dispersion devices. All right, the dispersion devices include the prism. And I should have brought one, now that I think about it. No, okay. I'll bring one next time. You know, it's a triangular piece of glass. What's the big deal? All right? So, but the big deal is that we must... What's the difference between a prism that looks like this and a prism that looks like this? Okay. The difference is the apical angle and the base length. Apical angle is this angle here. Right? These two prisms that I just drew have different apical angles. One has a very large apical, this is the apex, right? Apex of the triangle. So this is the apical angle, all right? It has nothing to do with those little animals that run around. Not that kind of ape, okay? So apical angle, all right? So that's the apical angle. So they have different apical angles and they have different base lengths. So these are the two design criteria. I'm going to design a prism, okay? And so I'm going to design it with some angle and some base length, right? Then, okay, besides the design criteria of the apical angle and the base length, I also have to specify the refractive index. Why? Because a prism is going to disperse the light based on the bending of the light as it passes from air into the material that the prism is made of, which might be glass or quartz. The light's going to bend. The reason a prism works is because different wavelengths of light bend to a different extent. Shorter wavelengths, longer wavelengths bend to a different extent. That's what this is telling us right here. The refractive index of the material is a function of the wavelength of light. All right, so the different wavelengths of light, then, if refractive index is a function of the wavelength of light, then different wavelengths of light are going to be slowed down to a different extent as they go through. They're going to be bent to different angles. So therefore, this is why when light passes into a prism, I get a spread of wavelengths. I get they don't all pass in the same place as they pass out. Okay, so I have a spread of wavelengths. I get a dispersion of the light, and I am able to see the spectrum of radiation. So I've got design criteria like the apical angle and the base length. Then I also have the material consideration, material has some refractive index. So the angular dispersion that I get, angular dispersion, which we said already is d theta d lambda, the angle over which the wavelengths are spread, that has two components to it. It has a component that has to do with we're split into two components. One is the change in the angle caused by the refractive index change for the different wavelengths of light. And the other is, it says here, dn d lambda, or the influence of the change in the wavelengths. Okay, the first one was the change in angle versus the change in the refractive index for the different wavelengths. This is the change in the refractive index for those different wavelengths. So those two components are combined together. Obviously, this cancels, right? And we get d theta d lambda. D theta d lambda. Okay, so the larger the angle, let's see, the angle changes with wavelength, the larger the better. So we want a greater dispersion. The greater the angular dispersion, the greater the spread of wavelengths. All right, that should be fairly okay. So here's where my little animation comes in. So the d theta d n is a function of the prism design, i.e. the angle. Okay, the dn d lambda is a function of the prism material. Comes from here. All right. Hey, it went away. Okay, increasing the angle. Okay, increases the d theta dn. Okay, but obviously, if I have a prism, okay, that looks like this, it's really short and stubby. Okay, when the light comes in, some of that light's going to reflect off. Right, the light's going to come in, it's going to reflect off surfaces in that prism. So internal reflections are greater. An apical angle of about 60 degrees is pretty optimum. So 60 degrees would be almost a equilateral triangle, right? It is an equilateral triangle, right? 60, 60, 60. If I change the material, okay, so dn d lambda depends on the material. Dn d lambda is greater at shorter wavelengths. You don't have any choice of that. Well, it depends on what wavelengths you want to use. But there is a relationship between the refractive index and the wavelength for prism materials, right? It's going to vary. The refractive index is going to vary with wavelength. Short wavelengths are bent the most, or they have the greatest influence, which is, I shouldn't say it's caused by the refractive index, but the refractive index is a measure of how great the influence or how great the light is bent. And so it's greater at shorter wavelengths because we said, you know, the sky's blue, the shorter wavelengths scatter more efficiently. So we see the greatest change at the shorter wavelengths. We see lesser change at the longer wavelengths. So this all combines to make a prism work. Linear dispersion, we just fixed the focal point, so we have to include F, okay, in our discussion of linear dispersion. It's the angular dispersion times the focal length. Okay? Depends on angular dispersion and focal length for constant bandwidth, so it must be varied. Okay. So see this line here? If I want a constant band pass, if I want a band pass of 2 nanometers, if I want 2 nanometers of light coming through when I'm down at 600 nanometers, and I want 2 nanometers of light passing through when I'm at 200 nanometers, okay? But wait, how's that going to work? Because the refractive index, we'll call this 200, we'll call this 600, okay? The refractive index is clearly different at those two locations. So the light is bent or is dispersed differently, greater at the shorter wavelength than it is at the longer wavelength. So if I had a fixed slit at the short wavelength, okay, I get 2 nanometers going through. When I get down to the long wavelengths, the refractive index isn't as great, and I may have a band of 10 nanometers passing through the same exact optical path that 2 nanometers of at 200 nanometers went through. 2 nanometers band pass at 200 nanometer wavelength went through. So if I want a fixed spectral slit width, a fixed band pass, I may have to vary the size of the physical slit. I may have to vary this opening in order to keep the spectral band pass the same across the spectrum of light. Some instruments have slits that open and close in order to give light, to give the same band pass at all regions of the spectrum. The instrument that this came out of, they don't care. They're going to give you a different spectral, your spectral band pass is going to vary across the spectrum of light. It's going to be different at 200 nanometers versus 600 nanometers. Okay. Alright, next time we'll talk about kinds of prisms and mountings. Okay, the mounting is how you set the system up, how you build your monochromator. Okay, so I'm going to build a box. I'm going to bolt in the components. All right. If I do it in a certain way, it's going to be a certain kind of mounting. I want you to know those. Okay, and I'm going to talk to you about different kinds of prisms. Only a couple different things. It's not that many. And I'll have all those exams created. If it kills me, I'll have it. Next Wednesday, and then we'll announce the next test, right? All right. Okay.